Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Mullen with Simon Schuster and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, we're going to be speaking with Lori Carpentier. She is the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Michigan. And Brad Williams, he is the head lobbyist for the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce. As we preview this week's Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce annual event up at Mackinac Island. But first, Simon Schuster, God bless you. You've spent 2 days solid in a courtroom with Todd Corser, otherwise known as the Wolfman, and Cindy Gamrat. 2 days, we don't have a resolution yet on whether this case is going to get kicked up to the circuit court. In a nutshell, what have you seen?
Well, it has certainly been a slog, to say the least. Many of these witness examinations have been drawn out very long. Tim Boland was on the stand for several hours from the morning and all the way throughout the afternoon yesterday.
And he's the House Business Office Manager.
Yes, and he was the director of the investigation behind their conduct in office. Everybody is given the third degree, and there's been a lot of objections from the prosecution. But Hugh Clark, seemingly in the interest of our entertainment, is allowing a lot of the answers to stand, regardless of their relevance to the case.
We're still not done with this preliminary exam.
No, we are not. There's still quite a few witnesses to be called. In June 14th, we will be resuming.
You know what's interesting here is that this is just a preliminary exam and that the fate of Corser and Gamrat are not necessarily going to be determined here. I mean, this is just to decide whether this is going to go to circuit court or not. Hugh Clark could short-circuit this thing for sure, but he is definitely treating this thing more like a trial than, I guess, what we would expect out of a preliminary exam, which oftentimes doesn't take more than a few hours. The judge takes a look at some evidence, says, yeah, there's enough, and kicks it on up.
Yes, certainly. And I mean, his stance so far has been, regardless of its relevancy to determining probable cause for these charges, let's listen to what the questions they have to ask, especially the defense of these witnesses, and let's hear their answers, and then he can decide later on whether or not they're relevant. The same is being determined for the recordings that were made, the initial recording that Ben Graham made in Todd Corser's Lapeer office that set off this whole thing. He hasn't ruled on whether or not he's even going to include that for the purposes of this examination, but right now a lot of the questions are being based off of some of those interactions.
So the circus is continuing, and I'm not going to cast any judgment on this. I just want to put this on the table for our listeners to remember, in case they forgot. Hugh Clark was appointed to the bench in late 2010 by Jennifer Granholm, and there was a little bit of a scuffle when Granholm left office and Snyder took office in 2011 as to whether Hugh Clark could legally continue on in that role. And in fact, the person who led the charge to the Supreme Court to ask whether Hugh Clark could stay on the bench was, yes, Bill Schuette, who is bringing the charges against Cindy Gamrat and Todd Corser. Not making any connection here. I'm just putting that out there that Hugh Clark has no love lost for Bill Schuette. While we're on the subject of Bill Schuette, Jacob, on Thursday we had some interesting back and forth here with Governor Snyder and Bill Schuette in regards to these overlapping investigations we're seeing on the Flint water crisis. Bill Schuette saying when the governor sent the state police in, he's compromising witnesses and has started an investigation that in which he told state employees that you have to talk to us or you're going to be fired, and what you say to us can't be used in a criminal investigation. And so now Schuette's all excited that what the auditors are doing right now could similarly maybe taint the waters for potential criminal charges.
Crazy situation here. I mean, obviously there's been a number of investigations launched over Flint. Everyone has kind of gotten in on that. And so now we're kind of seeing possibly what the fallout is when everyone's trying to kind of get a piece of the action. The thing that struck me was the governor's office's tone reacting to it. They really wanted to make it clear that they had never heard of any issues with the investigations that the state had initiated until this week. So their point being that the investigation started by the AG and the U.S. attorney started first. Later on, the governor announced that they were going to do an internal investigation, among other things, of the Department of Health and Human Services. And now we find out in May, the AG and U.S. attorney would have the state back off. So the governor's office seemed a little dismayed with the timing of all this.
It seems kind of interesting that if the AG was sniffing around the DEQ office, that they wouldn't have known until April that the state police was also in there conducting interviews. I mean, I don't know how all that works in there. It just kind of seems Like, if you were already stomping around the DEQ, you would have picked that up just, you know, by an employee saying, well, the state police has already talked to me.
That's a good point, but I think anyone in government will tell you whether it was a fault of theirs or they fell prey to the traditional silos in government, people not talking to each other that we see all the time.
Yeah, I don't know either. I do find it interesting, though, that Bill Schuette is kind of out there right now in this Flint water crisis. You know, when he put out those three charges against those individuals, he's indicated pretty strongly that there would be more.
Yeah,
and what happens if there isn't more?
Yeah, I mean, that is unusual, considering that the Attorney General usually sets the rules for what and how much he's going to comment on an investigation. For instance, we just found out last week that Schuette had already been investigating the Grand Rapids Veterans Home for months. So they kind of decide when they're going to publicize something and when they're not. It's usually unusual to kind of presumptively say there will be more charges, as he seemed to indicate when he announced the first three last month.
So is this giving him some cover? I mean, if there's nothing else that comes up, can he now say, well, the governor's office and the state police have tainted the waters and stomped through the flowers, and there's nothing more that we can get to. Thanks, guys.
I mean, yeah, possibly. I mean, the language you used, like, it could have hindered this investigation. It could have tainted. I mean, you know, those are you know, pretty serious-looking words, so could be an avenue for Schuette to get cover.
All right, well, we'll keep our eyes on that. Joining me now for the podcast is the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Michigan, Lori Carpentier. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, why don't you give our listeners a little background into what Planned Parenthood does? I think there's a perception among some that you guys only do abortions, but there's a lot more that you guys do.
Yeah, and on a visit number basis, abortion is a very small part of what we do, less than 10%. The vast majority of what we do is basic well women health care, so pap smears and breast exams and other screening for cancer, sexually transmitted disease testing and treatment, prenatal care, permanent birth control for both men and women, sort of the plethora of reproductive health care.
Now, are your services free or?
It depends on their income. So we are a recipient, one of 29 recipients in the state that get the benefit of Title 10, which is the Federal Family Planning Grant, and that allows us to offer services on a sliding fee scale. So it depends on a person's income and relative to the federal poverty guideline, but some of our patients are only asked for what they can pay in a donation.
And so as far as the abortion end of what you guys do, you end up being kind of the target for anti-abortion advocates. Why is that? Is that just because you're the most visible, or why is that?
I think it's twofold. I think that we are probably the most visible, and our opponents like to glom all of the 86 or 56 affiliates across the state and say we are the largest abortion provider in the country. And then I think it has ramped up in the last 10 years or so as our ability to highlight some of the political action that's happening against us has really grown. So we've become a player on the political realm, and that I think has made the target on our backs larger.
And let's talk about that, because it does seem like since Roe versus Wade, there's been a lot of chipping away on abortion and a woman's right to be able to get one. What do you credit that to? Why is that?
Well, I think it's a kind of a misnomer that it has been since Roe. I think after 1973, when the Roe versus Wade decision said that abortion was a matter between a doctor and his patient, we enjoyed a pretty long period of time where that was pretty accepted. And in my 30 years at Planned Parenthood, I remember very well a time when we were just kind of a mainstream organization and didn't have the hot button sort of attitude for many people. I think what changed was in the last 15 years or so, as some of the very right-wing legislators have gotten more traction, it has become a significant bipartisan issue. When it was not certainly always, anti-abortion status was not always part of the Republican plank. Planned Parenthood is first and foremost a nonpartisan issue, but we've had trouble finding candidates and elected officials who stand with us. So certainly that has occurred. And it probably has ramped up even more so in the last, I would say, 6 or 7 years. And I think it's become a political issue in a way that we had not seen previous to that.
And I wanted to mention that, too, because when I started in this town, there were a few pro-choice Republican legislators. You just don't have any anymore. And on the other hand, as far as Democrats, the number of pro-life or anti-abortion, Democrats have seemed to go down.
I think it has become startlingly partisan, and that's not something that we advocate. And for years, we had a lot of friends in legislatures, both here at the state level and also federally, that stood with Planned Parenthood and held the values that we did about allowing women access to comprehensive reproductive health care. And that now that it has become part of the plank of the Republican Party, that virtually no one can run and get the party support if in the Republican Party if they're pro-choice. I think that we are seeing even, there was more time in Lansing specifically where there were more Democrats that were anti-abortion. I think we're seeing that now to be dwindling, and there's actually significantly fewer anti-abortion Democrats than we have seen in the past. That said, I think that, you know, we would live well in a world if people could vote their conscience. And I know firsthand from a number of legislators who even take Right to Life's endorsement that tell me behind closed doors that they don't necessarily think this is the stance that they take personally, but it is one that is politically expedient, and I think that's unfortunate.
Talk about some of the things you've seen in the legislature, maybe this term, that you think are particularly gnawing.
You know, I think there's a common theme that folks, and often for political gain, that is my viewpoint, decide that they're going to take on the issue of the week. And these kinds of anti-abortion bills we've seen pop up all over the country. Things like after the videos that were a very well-calculated smear campaign that actually backfired on the people that made the videos against Planned Parenthood, an indictment of the man that made them. In response to that, we have the bill that says that you can't sell fetal tissue. I think it's of note that that wasn't occurring in Michigan anyway, but I think as a optics kind of thing, they want to be able to say, gee, not here in Michigan. I expect that if that were to pass and be signed by the governor, it would have a significant negative impact on research, biomedical research in the state. I think that would be unfortunate. I think often what I see is a dramatic lack of understanding of who we are and what we do and how women go about choosing to end pregnancies and how it fits in daily lives. And I think it's of note that 1 in 3 American women have had an abortion in their lifetime. But it is so stigmatized that I think very few people, even those closest to those women that have chosen that, are aware of that.
1 in 3?
1 in 3 American women have ended a pregnancy through abortion. And like I said, oftentimes because it's so stigmatized, people that are even closest to them don't understand it. So the likelihood is statistically is the vast majority of our legislators have people in their family who have made this choice, and they may be unaware of that.
One of the bills that had just passed is these abortion coercion bills.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your opinion on those. Are they necessary? Do you guys have a position on them?
We do have a position, and I think they were largely unnecessary. That was a bill that was an answer in search of a question or a problem, if you will. One of the things that we are very diligent about, because we know that if at the time that a woman is making the decision to end a pregnancy, if she feels comfortable and confident in the decisions that she's made, if she has good information, she's consulted the people that she loves, her physician, etc., she's going to feel okay about the fact that she made the best decision that she could make in that circumstance. So the notion that coercion and reproductive health coercion is limited to abortion is ludicrous. There are certainly as many young people who are forced to carry pregnancies to term that they may not want as anything else. And I think it's a misguided action on the legislature. And if they really cared about women's health, they would take much more opportunity to do legislation around penalties for domestic violence and make more resources available to women who find themselves in really difficult situations in that way. And yet that's not the kind of action we see.
Do you get the sense that the lawmakers are not putting women's health as a top priority?
It's not that I get the sense. I'm 100% certain they are not putting women's health as top priority. And those that are against abortion will now say that that's why, that they think that in many ways women are the victims of this process and that somehow they're being preyed upon by providers of the service or others. And I think that's the farthest thing from the truth. I think their agenda didn't get the kind of traction they wanted when they were all about just protecting the fetus. And I think that if you want to look for people who fight on behalf of women, it's Planned Parenthood and progressive people who know that access to birth control and information services and other kinds of broad health care are really what protects women and families, and they would join us in that rather than fighting us on everything.
What do you see 10 years from now on this front? Do you see things getting more divisive, or do you see folks coming around? What do you see happening?
I think it'll get worse, a little bit worse before it gets better. But I really think this issue will join the issue that we've and the progress we've seen on the LGBT front. I think what helped that issue move forward and become much more accepted and less debated was the notion that people, you know, had to go home to loved ones in their family who identified as gay or bisexual or transgender. Even somebody like Vice President Cheney had to go home to a daughter who was saying, "Really, Dad, why are you against my lifestyle?" And I think as the stigma around abortion reduces, and I think we're seeing that already, and people understand just how closely and often it has touched their family and people they love and understand the circumstances under which people make those decisions, I think the attitudes of people will change significantly.
Last thing I want to ask you about is the Planned Parenthood PAC. You guys have already made some endorsement in state legislature races, but I understand you're not done yet.
We're not done. We are still gathering questionnaires from interested parties, and once that all happens, then we'll put it before a group that makes decisions on those behalf, and then we'll award some small checks to people that are going to stand with us, and especially those that we think will be champions as these votes come before them.
Have you seen in all your questionnaires yet, have you gotten one back from a Republican?
Not to date. That was not true last cycle. We have had a couple of Republicans reach out, and some may not take our public endorsement, but they certainly stand with us and refuse to take the endorsement of Right to Life. And in this particular political atmosphere, we'll take that too.
And then of the Democrats that you receive information back from, how many are standing behind you?
Virtually all of them.
Really?
We have a very few number of Democrats now in either chamber that really don't stand with us and understand our issues. And we've had interesting conversations with a few that had some reservations on some very specific issues. And once they get added information, they're often able to come around, and we've seen people change their attitudes somewhat.
Lori Carpentier, she's the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Michigan. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Joining us now for the podcast is Brad Williams. He is a government relations director for the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for joining us, Brad.
Thanks, Kyle. Appreciate the time.
Obviously, this week is the Chamber Conference and a lot of things on the agenda. I was just going through this, and you guys got to be really excited about some of the things on here.
We are. I mean, I think every year we outdo ourselves with the lineup of speakers who are going to be on the agenda. But I think, you know, in particular this year, you know, we start this process pretty early and put together some pillars, and urban education was one of our three pillars at the beginning of the year, and certainly that's timely. Probably didn't know 9 months ago how timely it would be, but it's especially timely right now.
Not only the Detroit Public Schools thing, but we also have things on the automotive front, in particular automated cars, driverless cars, which is something that is coming quicker than we might think.
Yeah, and I think we have to be prepared for that as a state. Every other state, particularly California and Texas with Austin, really want to get out front on this mobility industry and the merging of auto and tech that we've seen over the last couple of years. And so we have to be ready for that as a state. We live in a world where, you know, there's 17.5 million cars built annually, and we're fighting the war to keep as many of them built in Michigan as possible. Plus, we are fighting this fight with other tech centers to keep the mobility in the R&D industry. We think we're well positioned to do so, but it's going to require a lot of focus as well.
The Flint water situation will be talked about too. Mona Ana Atisha's on the agenda here as well. Why did you put that on there?
Well, it's certainly something we've been focused on for quite some time. As a chamber, we count ourselves as part of an 11-county region that includes Genesee County. And it's certainly something that not only impacts the residents of our state, but also our economic development efforts. And so getting out on this issue and being as helpful as possible is certainly a priority for us.
So I was looking for the Big Four on here. Are we having a Big Four this year?
You know, it's been a few years since we've done a Big Four. And part of the reason when we started that several years ago, before I even started at the chamber, it was a very unique event. We were the only ones who did it. And now, as you you know, go about the region, the Big Four gets together several times a year. And so the idea of doing it at the conference isn't as unique as it once was. So now we try and strategically put the regional leadership in places where it's going to be strategically important. So, for example, this year, we've got the mayor on stage doing a keynote address. And one thing we find every year, when we bring in world-class speakers, nationally renowned speakers, when we go out and poll our attendees as to who they liked and who they liked maybe a little bit less, the mayor's always at or close to the top of the list. So we're excited to give him some time on stage again this year.
The big four, of course, also is the Oakland County exec, the Wayne County exec, and the Macomb County exec. The other thing I wanted to talk about, too, is the timing of the conference. And it's always that week after Memorial Day. And for legislators down here, it never seems to be a convenient time because now with Snyder, they always want to seem to get the budget done by June 1st. Talk about the timing of that, and has there ever been any real serious discussion about moving the chamber?
There's been some preliminary investigation of it, and you know, the fact of the matter is there's never going to be a perfect time for everybody. You know, certainly the last 5 years with the budget, it's created a little bit more of a crunch. But you know, you got to recognize also once you get further into the summer, people have vacations planned, other sorts of things planned, and the Grand Hotel has other events too. So you know, we've been doing this for 35 years, I think, now, the same week. And, you know, it's not perfect for everybody, but we think it works pretty well.
Obviously, the House said that they were not going to be taking time off so that its members could come up here. We've seen this before where the House hasn't shown up. What is the chamber conference like with the House members there and when they're not there?
Well, I think, you know, we're certainly disappointed that the House isn't going to be there. But on the flip side, we're, you know, very enthused that, you know, once again, the governor and the mayor are going to have very significant presence, both on stage and off stage. The state Senate will be there. We've got robust representation from the congressional delegation. So while we're disappointed that the House isn't going to be there, there's still going to be a very significant policymaker presence. There'll certainly be some change. There'll be a few more hotel rooms available, though they've gotten snatched up pretty quickly. You know, we'd love to have them there. We hope that the timing will work out next year and we can get them back up there.
How many times have we had this where the House has not shown up?
3 years ago we had it, and that was more a case of changing some timing on the conference. We wanted to start earlier and end sooner for the Grand Prix so that our members who participate in that could have time as well. And so that was really the reason a few years ago. Other than that, I don't know, you know, at least in my time, we certainly haven't had that, but our participation from legislators has evolved over the years, too.
What do you mean by that?
Several years ago, we had an invitation list of legislators we invited. It wasn't all 148.
Oh.
And what we realized after a while is that, you know, whether they were on the invitation list or not, they still came.
And imagine that.
Maybe enjoyed some of the non-sanctioned activities. And so we thought, you know, if they want to be here, we want to have them.
Sure.
And so it's been in the last 10 years or so that every legislator has been invited. And when they're there, they're certainly a very valuable part of the conference. Our members appreciate their participation. But this year we ran into a hiccup, and that's okay. It's still going to be a great conference. We'll still have, you know, 1,600 plus people registered for the conference and having very significant conversations about how we move our state forward.
Do you buy their reason that they're staying here because they have work to do on the budget?
They do have work to do, and we're not opposed to them doing the work. I think beyond the budget, there's a very, very significant issue of Detroit Public Schools that's hanging out there, and we've spent a lot of time and energy working on that issue. In, you know, in my view, if their staying back in Lansing and continuing to work leads to a positive resolution on Detroit Public Schools, then that's going to be a win, not just for us as an organization, but for the entire state.
Is it possible there could be some politics at play here?
You know, I don't know. You know, there's speculation, and I'm not going to, you know, be a part of that speculation. No one's said anything to us one way or the other. We will take them at their word that they want to sit here and continue to get their work done in Lansing and be hopeful that they're going to continue to move in the right direction, particularly on Detroit Public Schools. It's going to be something we talk about a lot on the island. The good news is that this conference is streamed across the state. Whether you're physically on the island or not, you can watch every single session online. We're hopeful that...
Where would they have to go?
On the Detroit Public TV website, dptv.org, I believe. We're hopeful that they will, those that are here, will still be able to participate in a meaningful way over the internet, even if they're not physically there as well.
The thing you're most excited about this week?
You know, one of the most recent announcement is pretty exciting to me, and that's that Dan Gilbert's going to be on stage. Certainly, he's played an exceptionally important role in our city's comeback, particularly in the core. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what he has to say about what's next, because we've seen, and anyone who's been to Detroit recently has seen, that the comeback in downtown and midtown is self-evident. But we also know that downtown and midtown aren't enough. They're important, but they're not enough, and we need to take this prosperity and move it into the neighborhood so that every Detroiter has an opportunity to benefit from this. So I'm really excited to kind of hear his take on that, and I know he's had a lot to do with blight removal projects and employing Detroiters and improving their lives, and so I'm looking forward to hearing more.
Very good. Brad Williams with the Detroit Regional Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for MERS Monday. Thanks to Jacob and Simon, Lori Carpentier, and Brad Williams. Till next week, I'm Kyle Moore. Take care.